Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. And let me tell you something, nothing matters more to your money than taxes. And this week we heard from the finance minister about how the national budget is going to affect our taxes, as well as what they're going to be doing and spending our money, our taxes on. This is a particularly contentious budget this year. Sure, as you already know, the first budget was actually proposed in February, where government aimed to collect 58 billion rand more in tax, mostly through a 2 percentage point increase in VAT. This was rejected by cabinet and the minister had to return with other alternatives. Now, personally, I actually think this was a great opportunity to explain that, you know, if we don't have money, then we can't spend unless we take on more debt. And the government is like any household. We can't spend money we don't have. So unless we want to put it on our ballooning credit card balance, we're faced with a dilemma. Do we reduce spending or do we find ways to increase income? The problem is that for government, the only way to increase income is to increase taxes, and that comes directly from you and from me. So no matter what you want to call this tax, whether it's VAT or personal income tax, corporate tax or excise duty, those things we call sin taxes, ultimately the residents of the country pay for it. And those are the choices facing National Treasury and the Finance Minister. Cut spending or raise taxes. So in the February budget, government wanted 58 billion through VAT, but now in March, they're settling for 28 billion collected through some VAT and some personal income tax. So today I'm really, really excited to be speaking to Chris Axelson, who is the acting head of tax and financial sector policy at National Treasury. So welcome, Chris. Your job is literally tax policy. And I would love you to give us some insights into how you go about making decisions, or at least the team do, on where to raise, for example, 28 billion. What are the options? How do you make these decisions?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for having me, Maya. So maybe just two things. So we don't make decisions. We try and provide advice to the minister, and then the minister can hopefully get the best advice he needs and, you know, make those decisions and come to an agreement. So, you know, what do we do? We do a lot of scenarios, and we've done more than our fair share the last couple of weeks as well on top of what we normally do. But we try and go through, you know, the main tax instruments. What will the impact be on the economy? What will the impact be on behavior? What will the impact be on households? We're very worried about that. I mean, the first thing to do is to say, you know, do we even need tax increases? You know, so we spend a lot of time looking at how much revenue is coming in, you know, how much revenue we think we're going to get. We spend a lot of time forecasting. Then we have to chat with our colleagues on the expenditure side to say, well, you know, what's happening on the expenditure side? Are there more pressures? Are there less? Can we cut? Can we not? Then we chat to our colleagues on the borrowing side. So there's a very nice budget group within Treasury where we have to put all these pieces together and then try to decide, you know, do we need more taxes? Do we not? And take all those things into consideration. If you get to a point, as we did in this budget, which is, okay, we actually need more revenue. We couldn't cut any further. Our borrowings hit a limit. There are important expenditure pressures that we need to fund and the minister wants to fund. We need revenue to do that. How do we go about doing it? So we look at lots of options. The biggest problem with this type of budget is the amount required is large. So as you said, you know, 58 billion in the non-budget on the 19th of Feb. But there are only three big taxes that make anywhere near enough money, you know, and that's personal income tax, corporate income tax, and value-added tax. You know, the amount we required, 58, was more than all of the excise duties we get on alcohol and tobacco. You know, and you can't double, you know, those excise duties.
Well, in theory, but no one will like you very much.
Can. Yes, no. And also, I mean, it'll just push people to the illicit market again. We, you know, the big problems in the tobacco industry in terms of illicit trade. So, you know, what do you do there? The fuel levy, which is the fourth highest, is 90 billion. You know, so you can't raise the fuel levy to try and get 60 billion. And it's also got very bad distributional consequences. You know, for example, on fuel, there's no zero rating on fuel. You know, you can't, it'll affect everybody. It affects prices across the board. Transport costs are a huge component of low-income households' budget. and you'd be pushing those up. So we are concerned about the fuel levy as well. But for example, we look at those options. We say, okay, well, could we push up a bit on the fuel levy? Could we push up a bit more on alcohol or tobacco? But if you want to make large amounts, you've got to look at those top three. And then, of course, in the first budget, the non-budget, we went with a 2 percentage point increase in VAT. And a lot of it is because we think that is the best way to get growth going. Now, I was listening to your intro, and you said, you know, the only way to increase income is tax. But the other way is growth. And if you can get economic growth going, which is what we desperately need to do, you'll have high revenues over the medium term anyway. But if you're going to increase taxes and completely undermine growth, you're not going to get the revenues you need. So that is the one instrument which is broad-based, it's efficient. You know, a lot of the research has shown that it's got less of a negative impact on the economy than the other taxes. So we went for that approach. But now, of course, there is this impact on households. As we said, we don't just look at the economic impact, we look at the household impact, the distributional impact. And we tried, you know, very hard to say, well, let's increase social grants, for example, by a much higher amount than inflation. So actually, we can look at like a basket of goods and say, this is the basket of goods that a low-income household normally has. There's a very good group, Peter Maritzburg Economic Justice Group, that has this basket of goods and tracks it over time, and say, well, what would the VAT increase do? What is that increase? And let's increase grants by an amount to cover it completely to try and cushion the impact. So we look at those, and you've got to put those decisions together. We looked at other issues like medical tax credits. Could you get rid of those? Because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about that. But a lot of the credit actually goes to lower and middle income households. And we put a chart in the budget review about that to show that, you know, I think more than, you know, 50% goes to households below 500,000. Because it's a credit, it's the same value regardless of what income you're on. We looked at retirement fund deductions. You know, could you reduce those as well? But then it undermines savings. There are complications there because, you know, at the end, you're not paying tax. So if you tax it now, does that mean you're not going to tax it when you draw it at retirement? And then we lose money later on. So there are these other complications around those as well. And hopefully, we've got to the next budget that is potentially going to get passed, but it might not. Anyway, but those are the sort of things we consider in the advice that we try to provide.
I mean, I think that really shows this balancing act of trying to find a way through it. But one thing, Chris, you said VAT is better for growth than personal income tax. Now, obviously, one can understand logically if you tax people, they don't have money to spend. But you could also say, well, if goods become too expensive due to VAT, people don't spend either. So why would VAT be more growth, pro-growth than tax, personal tax?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, part of it is, you know, your incentives to work, to save are not reduced by VAT. Actually, it helps you save because now if you consume more, you know, you'll be taxed more. So there's a, you know, there's an argument to say, well, now I want to save more, which is better for investment. It also doesn't reduce the incentives to work. If you work harder, it's not going to reduce how much you get as take-home pay. Whereas, you know, big rate changes on personal income taxes do reduce those incentives. You say, well, oh, I can work X amount more, but I'm only going to get 55% of my money back. Or if you increase it, only 50% of my money back. And you say, well, you know, what's the point? So it's, or, you know, there are other jurisdictions around the world, Mauritius, it's a 15% flat rate. You know, and individuals can say, well, let me go and try and ply my trade, you know, over there. So those sort of factors that influence behavior are more prominent in personal income tax, and they're more prominent in corporate income tax, especially. You know, you get multinationals who say, well, if the rate is very high, I'm going to try and headquarter somewhere else, or I'm going to try and shift my profits offshore, which we then spend a lot of time creating legislation to try and stop. So those are the reasons behind why, if you look at empirical studies, they found that growth is higher in countries where they haven't had these large increases in PRT and CRT, whereas VAT is broad-based, and also the business itself doesn't pay. They can get refunds on everything that they pay in VAT, but they are worried about pricing. So, you know, if they just put the whole VAT increase through, maybe it'll reduce demand. So it's not that they don't have an incidence of VAT, they do, but it goes through the whole value chain, and it's very broad. It's efficient. A lot of the economic literature says it's better for growth, and we believe it. So we look at those multipliers as well. There are different views on this. Economists have different views on everything, but I think that's our approach.
And you were saying, it becomes a disincentive. High tax becomes a disincentive to work. As a freelancer, I get to a point where I think, well, if I take this extra work, I'm only going to get 55% of what. So you do start to realize that the harder you work, the more money you're going to be paying in tax. So I actually quite that resonated with me, Chris, as you were speaking.
Yeah, maybe one more point there. Sorry, just because we also did it before. So in 2017, we increased it from 41 to 45%, the top rate. And then we get this wonderful anonymized data from SARS where we get per taxpayer anonymized data so that we can actually look at what happened at a per taxpayer level. And it looks as if taxpayers changed their behavior so much that it completely eroded the revenue we thought we would get from that higher rate. And we've put a couple of charts in there to show this reduction in taxable income. And then you reduce that taxable income, we lose the revenue, and then it's saying, well, what is the point? And then those questions of have we reached the top of the Laffer curve, come to the fore. So because of that evidence, when we compare ourselves to other developing economies, that top rate is higher. It also kicks in at a much lower level compared to developed economies. So it's just difficult to push it further. Not that we won't. I mean, I could say this now and then we increase it next year, but it's one of those reasons where if you look at the evidence, we don't think it's the best approach, and that's why we didn't go for it.
Okay, but of course, and you know this because you and I had a brief chat about this on Budget Day, there is, you have actually increased tax for personal tax without obviously changing it. And that is what we call fiscal drag. So fiscal drag is where you don't adjust the tax tables and you don't adjust the primary rebate by inflation so that anyone receiving an inflation-linked increase will actually land up paying more tax. You did this last year, so in 2024, we didn't. Nobody got any adjustment on the tax tables for inflation, and again, this is where the big 18 billion rand has come from. So, actually, you have increased personal taxes by 34
No,
billion
definitely.
years. I mean, that would be a true statement.
No, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't argue that at all. It's true. I mean, a lot of people refer to it as a stealth tax because it's, you can't see it. We're not actually changing anything, but you pay more. I'll come back because that, we're not trying to hide it. It's in all the documentation. We're very clear that, look, we've raised an extra 16 billion from personal income tax last year. We're trying to raise an extra 18 billion this year from personal income tax. Through this mechanism. The trick for us is that because it's not a rate change and it's spread across so many people very thinly, which is why it's almost seen as like a stealth, the behavior change isn't very large. So when we look at, previous years when we've done this, we've made a lot of the revenue. People haven't tried to adjust their tax affairs to avoid it because it looks like it's a marginal change. They can't really see it. It's a very different, as you said earlier, you think, well, should I take a bit of extra work? I'm only getting, 55% of this. If it's now 50%, it changes your thinking a lot. But with the bracket creep, have you even thought about how it like would affect you? I mean, it's the marginal amount is the same at the top. It's still 55, even though on amounts above those brackets. So it's not as visible. Which means there's less behavior, which means we get more, but we're not hiding away from the fact that we raise it. The problem is, of course, like part of this VAT increase was to try and diversify our tax base as well. Like our personal income taxes have been pushed a lot since 2015, and that percentage of GDP from personal income tax has just gone up and up and up and up. And we're trying to diversify again to get those indirect taxes like VAT back up as well, because you don't want to be over reliant on one type of tax revenue. So it is a difficult consideration. And I must say, we have certainly increased PIT quite a lot, but it's the rate changes that we've been trying to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, I did a little bit of maths on looking at the relative increase of VAT, a 2 percentage point increase in VAT versus this bracket creep. And for an entry level earner, somebody earning 8,000 rand, 8,000 rand in 2023, you were not in the tax bracket. If you've had just an inflation increase for 2 years, you're sitting at 8,700 rand. You're now in the tax bracket. You're paying about 130 rand a month in tax. So, you probably wouldn't be paying that extra in VAT if it was a 2 percentage point increase. So I think there's a lot to consider, and this is the whole debate. But it's almost like it's easier to sell a stealth tax in a way than it is VAT. So this is why it's important that we have these discussions, that people understand how these decisions are made, and maybe react differently to to tax proposals going forward. And I know there was no, you can hardly, when you're looking for tax, I mean, you're even considering reducing the amount that people can benefit from retirement annuities for retirement contributions. But we have not seen any increases in tax-free savings accounts, Chris. The monthly, the annual contribution of 36,000. I think if that had been adjusted for inflation by now, we should be allowed to take about 44,000 rand a year. Are we ever going to see that change?
No, I'm sure we will. I mean, we look at these threshold changes, every year, and say, well, has it been adjusted? Has it not? Should we make an inflationary adjustment or not? In this budget, we did adjust, for example, the transfer duty tables on properties by quite a bit. In previous budgets, we do, these threshold changes. We have got calls from the public, and it's in the back of my mind because we did put it in a budget review. A couple of years ago, to say we actually need to formalize this process a little bit better, and put a discussion document out to say, well, how are we thinking about rate changes? So, for example, the interest exemption, we've got some commenters saying, but you're not increasing the interest exemption, so it's not helping it. But it was always a policy position to say, well, we're going to freeze the interest exemption and introduce a tax-free savings account. So, there's no intention to try and adjust that interest exemption. Again, a minister next year might disagree with me and do it, but it's, the policy position at the moment is that. So those ones we should, I mean, and hopefully we can. The lifetime allowance is slightly different, and we have a bit of an internal debate on that issue because I suppose from my perspective, the lifetime allowance is there to say you've got this big benefit over your lifetime. But if you keep adjusting that for inflation, it'll never bite. And then there was no point in sort of having a lifetime, allowance. And the big trick there was to say, if someone has been able to contribute that much and get all these tax benefits, do they need further tax benefits? But on the other hand, it's no, but now you're going to undermine savings because then that person who could save and keep it in the country is now not. So there's always these pros and cons to these types of things. But we certainly will look at tax-free savings accounts and those limits again next year.
Good. Looking forward to that. Now we, I mean, we've spoken about the 28 billion that's being raised, we think, at the stage. What is this extra tax going to be spent on? You said that, the ministers and government has come and said we need this extra money. There's priorities we have, we need the extra money. Where primarily has it gone? Or will it go?
So, I mean, the minister's really strong on this. And it's very difficult not to agree with him. It's, you've got doctors who've qualified, but they're sitting at home because there's no funding for them. Like, you need money for them to get them to start work as soon as possible. There are teacher vacancies across the country. There are also reductions in budgets where teachers might need to get fired in some provinces if they don't get additional funding. And a lot of these, we didn't try and overplay this, but a lot of these types of frontline services would help poorer households directly. There's also a big additional adjustment for early childhood development, which, you could say potentially has been underfunded. And a lot of the money is going to that, so that young mothers can get their young children into these centers. They can go to work. There will be more teachers to look after them, more facilities to look after them while they're at work. Those are very important aspects that can really improve people's lives. And so it's all about those frontline services and health and education. There is also additional funding, to boost defense. There have been some, difficult situations going on in defense in the last couple of months, and for correctional services. Part of it was for a higher than expected wage bill agreement. And the other big part of it is about infrastructure and a big push on infrastructure to try and get this medium term growth going. You've got to get the logistics working, you've got to get water systems working. Those things all undermine growth and the potential growth, within an economy. So there are a lot of good things that are spent on. A lot of the criticism can be, well, you need to stop corruption, and just reduce the waste. But it's difficult. There's no line item for corruption. There's no line item for waste that you can
Surprisingly
tap
not, because
to,
it would be
you know.
so easy. We just said, oh, we're going to remove the
Yes.
corruption line item this year.
And I mean, and it's a good point, you know, and I think Treasury, as much as anyone, is saying, you know, we'd love to reduce those issues, you know, reduce those components. But, you know, we can't, it's not as easy to do. So it's, you know, if you need that funding now, you have to do something now. And, you know, also coming back to growth is a huge thing. We need to get growth going. But growth is not going to happen from 1 April, where we're suddenly going to get additional revenue. You know, and if you need funding to help the teachers, the doctors, the, you know, these departments, frontline services, you know, you had to do something. So, you know, that's what it was really for, which was quite a progressive move, in my view.
I think it's important. I think it is important that people know that that's where it's going, because I don't think there's anyone who argues against teachers and nurses, and you know that it is seen as underpinning society. And I mean, that is the social wage we often talk about. 60% of the budget, 1.5 trillion, I think. 1.52 trillion goes to learning and culture, health, community development, and social development, and that really underpins the society. So, and I think it's that is important. But what I wanted to ask you about, I want to end off with asking about, spending reviews. But before we get there, one of the things that was introduced, has been introduced into the budget, is this concept of a primary surplus. Now, that's a bit confusing to people, because they'll hear that we collect 2.2 trillion in taxes, but we spend 2.6 trillion, which is a deficit, right? It's about 370 billion that we're spending more than we are receiving. Any household will be getting more and more into debt. So what is a primary surplus?
Yeah, there is a we do get that a lot, and people say, "Oh, but you've got a primary surplus, so you must use that primary surplus for something else." But it's not. I mean, the primary surplus is only and only just taking debt service costs out of the equation. So it's how much revenue you are getting versus how much you are spending, but ignoring debt service costs. So it's we have a big budget deficit. Well, not big, it's getting smaller. We're trying to get a bit better for this year. I think it'll be 4.7%. Next year it's like 4.4. But which means that we are spending more than we're getting in revenue. But a lot of that spending goes right to interest, like debt service costs, to interest payments. Whereas if you take that those interest payments out and then look at revenue and expenditure, actually for the first time last year in a long time, we got more revenue than we did have expenditure. Ignoring debt service costs, which is a good thing. And you need this primary surplus so that you can stabilize debt. Our debt has just been shooting up and it's now got above 70. You can only stabilize that debt if you've got a primary surplus. And we need a bigger primary surplus because our growth rate is lower than the interest payment that we pay on our debt. So we need that primary surplus to be a bit bigger. And then hopefully we can stabilize debt this year and then it can start coming down. And maybe eventually we could get to, you know, a budget balance that isn't in deficit. But the big point of call and what Treasury has been pushing for is to stabilize debt through that primary surplus.
And it's very important to understand these debt costs, because I think we're spending 22% of the budget on debt, servicing debt. Now, any household will say, well, that's less than I'm spending on my debt. But you've got to realize that government's not paying back the capital. That's just interest. So to me, I always say it's almost as if that's what you're paying in your credit card bills. Like your credit card bill alone, because you're never really paying off the capital of that thing, it's mostly interest, is just 22% of your salary is going just to service interest and never paying off the debt. So it's extremely important that we get that get that debt under control. And one of the other things that we talk about finding more money, is of course SARS. And I know you're not the commissioner, but so I'm not sure how much you can comment on this, but I was very interested to see that he's been given 7.5 billion over the next 3 years. And primarily he's using that to get people who have not paid, who owe SARS money, bad creditors, I suppose you want to call them, and people with outstanding tax returns. I mean, do you have any sense how that's going to boost collections and revenue in this next year?
No, thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, I've always been a supporter of giving SARS more resources. It's always been difficult in an environment where you're cutting departments everywhere. But SARS, you know, if SARS works well, you can get revenue in. And if they can cut down on non-compliance, it's huge, not just from a revenue perspective, but from like a social fabric perspective. If you see people that aren't paying their taxes, but you're paying, it's very upsetting, it's very annoying. And people want to see fairness and equity in the whole system. So giving SARS more resources got a lot of political backing, and it's a lot of additional money that's going to them over the next 3 years. It's almost as much as going to health and education in this adjusted budget. We do hope that they can bring in a lot more revenue from that. I mean, we're not quite clear how much. They've got some idea. We haven't penciled in any additional revenue in our fiscal framework. And it's not that we don't believe that they'll get it. It's just that we're not quite sure how much, and it's a little bit risky to do so. You're counting on money before it's really come in. But we hope that that will work. So the reducing the debt is a great thing. That doesn't flow through to outer years. So you reduce debt once, and then you get additional revenue, but it's not gonna be there next year, and it's not gonna be there the year after that. So you can't base expenditure decisions on that. But if they can reduce non-compliance and reduce the tax gap, that would be a huge win for the country in all sorts of ways. So we really do hope that they can be successful in that effort.
I remember, Chris, I've covered, I think, 20 budgets now. So I remember even during Trevor Manuel's days, he was able to run a budget surplus because of tax compliance. There was such goodwill to paying taxes. SARS went through a huge sort of modernization at that time, and that increase in compliance really gave the country options. So I think that that is going to be key. And of course, it's very difficult. I had an interview earlier today with on a radio show, and they were saying that people are angry about the corruption and they don't want to pay tax. So it does, of course, require a lot of government sorting out that part as well to make people feel they want to pay tax, So I think that's an important point. But I just wanted to finish off on the calls for the spending review. And this has come through. I was listening to the minister in his budget speech as well. He spoke about it quite a few times. What does that mean? And what does it mean for you at Treasury?
Well, yeah, so there's this incredible statistic that there've been more than 240 spending reviews done. And basically a spending review, you get into the nitty-gritty of a program and you say, well, is it worthwhile? Are you getting the objectives of that program, whatever that government program is, whether it's provincial roads, whether it's housing, rental housing, whatever it is. Some of them are dated because it's obviously been happening over quite a long time. But a lot of those, and then I suppose a little bit awkwardly, is some of them, say actually this program needs a bit more money because it's being effective, or it needs to be effective and it needs more resources. But the point is to look at all these programs, fresh eyes, and say, what really don't we need? There's a line that the minister put into his speech yesterday. It was only yesterday, about we would. Consider the second 0.5 percentage point increase if some of these things are successful. I mean, there should be a lot of incentive for departments to do that, but they are up to the department. So the Treasury can try, but it's the accounting authorities and the departments that make those type of decisions, unless we make big changes, to programs to try and reduce. Because, there are a lot of calls to say reduce corruption, reduce government spending, and those aren't falling on deaf ears. There's a lot of a drive to do that. It's just unfortunately not as easy as raising tax.
Unfortunately, and
But the work will be done, yeah.
the work will be done, and that is the problem. It's easier to raise taxes than to go and review your budget. To be perfectly honest, just if I think about my own household, if I had the option to just keep increasing my income rather than having to sit there with the family and decide we're cutting back on date night, that's hard, right? It's much easier. And but maybe now government's getting such pushback on raising taxes, they're going to have to sit and cut back on date night. So maybe that's not a bad thing, Chris. But I really want to say thank you so much. As always, I always enjoy speaking to you because you are able to explain things simply, clearly, and I think you've given the listeners a really good insight into the challenges of putting together a budget. And let's well, in the next few days, they'll tell us if it gets accepted or not. But thank you.